The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
In business, risks and rewards come with every decision, like moving to the cloud with Office 365. While its benefits include anywhere access and lower costs, cyber threats and user errors can quickly wipe out data and the money you save. Barracuda Essentials for Office 365 provide an added layer of security and functionality for threat protection, email migration, data recovery, and quality of service. Move securely to Office 365. Visit barracuda.com/essentials to learn more.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. James Comey tells his story. How the White House is responding. Plus, Apple's Swiss Army speaker.
It has tweeters, it has woofers, it has motors that move air around. It has technology that measures the size of the room it's in.
And later, Kevin Spacey on life imitating art in Washington.
Something or five things that are very close to what we developed and dealt with in our show happens sort of in the real world.
I'm Steve Dorsey at the CBS News Washington Bureau. Let's get started this weekend, as we often do, by talking with CBS News White House correspondent Stephen Portnoy. Hi, Stephen.
Hey, Steve.
We're hearing from the president himself now about fired FBI Director James Comey, who testified to a Senate committee Thursday.
The president was remarkably restrained on Thursday. He didn't say anything on Twitter for about 48 hours between the day before Comey's testimony and then Comey's testimony. But it was Friday morning, 6:10 a.m., in which he said, quote, "Despite so many false statements and lies, total and complete vindication. And wow," he said, "Comey is a leaker." So the president believes that what Comey said was vindication. The president also talked about it at his joint news conference Friday alongside the president of Romania.
James Comey confirmed a lot of what I said, and some of the things that he said just weren't true.
Stephen, what about Comey's testimony does the president's team refute?
The president's personal attorney, Mark Kasowitz, read a statement on Thursday in which he essentially accused James Comey of lying under oath when Comey said that the president had requested his loyalty, that the president had urged him to drop the Michael Flynn matter. Kasowitz said neither in form nor in substance did the president do either one of those things. So what we have now is essentially a he said, he said. The only thing that might be able to clear it up are those tapes that the president tweeted about last month.
Do we have any indication that they actually exist?
We don't have any indication that they actually exist. The president's spokeswoman, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, said on Thursday that she would look under the couches, but she otherwise said she didn't know. I will tell you, Steve, that's the most we've heard from the president's spokespeople about this. When the president first tweeted about the specter of there being tapes, they wouldn't even answer any questions about it at all.
Pulling back on this, how do you think all of the spotlight on the Russia investigation and the president's potential involvement in that affects the U.S.-Russia relationship?
Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia, has said that there's nothing to any of these allegations. He suggested that children could be behind the hacking of the Democrats in the last election. He even suggested in a recent interview that maybe the CIA had something to do with it, because some people believe the conspiracy theories that suggest that the CIA had something to do with the Kennedy assassination. Inasmuch as this story is not going anywhere, it certainly isn't doing anything to improve the relationship between the U.S. and Russia.
CBS News White House correspondent Stephen Portnoy. Thanks again, Stephen.
You bet, Steve.
Let's talk now with Admiral James Stavridis. He led NATO for 4 years, so he's one of the people familiar with Russia. Admiral, thanks for talking with us.
What a pleasure to be with you, Steve.
All right, so you're familiar with Russia's thinking, their strategy. What do you think is next for U.S.-Russia relations?
I think, unfortunately, we've got a period of real conflict ahead. We have three fundamental global-level disagreements with Russia. One is over Syria and their support for the dictator Assad. The second is over their invasion of Ukraine and annexation of Crimea. And the third and the biggest one is their intrusion using cyber into our electoral process. Those aren't going away, so I foresee a great deal of challenge in that relationship ahead.
You mentioned that Russian interference in the U.S. presidential election. You've spoken before about the Russia probe here in the U.S., about James Comey, about Robert Mueller. What more do you want to learn about why perhaps the president fired Comey and where the Justice Department's investigation into Russia goes?
I think first and foremost, we have to make a commitment to follow the facts wherever they lead. And I think point one is that this is beyond the executive branch's ability to solely do because of conflicts of interest. I'm pleased that Attorney General Sessions has recused himself, and I'm pleased that there's effectively an independent investigator in former FBI Director Mueller. But this is going to require congressional oversight and follow the facts where they go. And the fundamental thing we need to know is, was there active collusion between the Trump campaign and the government of Russia in the lead up to the election? That is a very big deal if it is correct.
What effect, if any, do you think Comey's firing had on that investigation?
I think it's like throwing a match into a pool of gasoline. It's inexplicable to me why the Trump administration would have chosen to do that.
You've got a new book called Sea Power, The History and Geopolitics of the World's Oceans. Russia and China play a large part in that with our naval arms race right now. Why?
Because Russia is actively rebuilding their navy, which they effectively took offline after the end of the Cold War because they really couldn't afford it. But now they have come back with a vengeance and are beginning to operate their ships in places we haven't seen since the Cold War, Steve. They're up in the Arctic. They're in the Greenland-Iceland gap in the North Atlantic. They're operating off the coasts of the United States. They're challenging us in the Eastern Mediterranean and the Baltic Sea. So they are determined to become global maritime players on a world scale. China, on the other hand, is introducing new dangerous technology, hypersonic missiles, stealthy mines that can attack our ships, and above all, their aviation at sea. They're beginning to build aircraft carriers. So both of those nations are building, and they will challenge the United States Navy at sea.
Yeah, but it was a different time, wasn't it, in World War II, even after that, where armed conflicts were playing out at sea in many cases. These days, it's playing out online.
What we are seeing is the rise of these conflicts that are moving into areas like the Eastern Mediterranean, like the South China Sea, like the Arctic. That's exactly the point, Steve, is that we had a period of about 20 years where the oceans became kind of American lakes. We could go and do what we wanted. Now we're being challenged actively again. We need to move from what we have thought of as power projection, strikes from aircraft carriers, Tomahawk missiles, to sea control, the ability to control large chunks of the ocean, because we have competition out there.
Admiral James Stavridis, author of Sea Power, The History and Geopolitics of the World's Oceans. Admiral, you're always welcome back.
What great questions. Thanks for having me on, Steve.
Meanwhile, the president has nominated a new person to lead the FBI. His name, Christopher Wray. And as correspondent Jeff Pegues reports, he's got experience managing high-profile investigations and a bombastic boss.
He is someone who has experience as a prosecutor. He was nominated to be assistant attorney general by President George W. Bush. He served from 2003 to 2005, and then he's been out of private practice for the last 12 years or so. And during his time in private practice, he has represented Chris Christie in connection with this Bridgegate scandal.
CBS's Jeff Pegues reporting. Still to come, what's next for Britain's prime minister?
We will continue to work with our friends and allies.
That's next on the Weekend Roundup. On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. British Prime Minister Theresa May briefly spoke to reporters Friday morning after a meeting with the Queen at Buckingham Palace, where she asked permission to form a government after a party failed to earn a majority in a snap election Thursday.
We will continue to work with our friends and allies in the Democratic Unionist Party in particular.
But you'll also have to work with the Labour Party, which did gain seats in Parliament. Correspondent Mark Phillips has more from London.
Well, what if they held an election and nobody won? That's effectively what's happened here. Theresa May did take a huge gamble, thinking she could cruise to a big majority. That didn't happen. That's losing.
More than anything else, this country needs a period of stability. And whatever the results are...
The results for her were disastrous. She had called the snap election while riding a double-digit opinion poll lead.
I have just chaired a meeting of the cabinet where we agreed that the government should call a general election.
She built her campaign around her leadership, which she called over and over again.
Strong and stable. Strong and stable. Strong and stable leadership.
but she looked, her opponent said, weak and wobbly, refusing to do TV debates, flip-flopping on policy. And Jeremy Corbyn, her main opponent, turned out not to be as bad a campaigner as many thought. He ran on an old-style tax-and-spend platform, appealed to the youth vote. A kind of British Bernie Sanders.
I'm going to be near where Corbyn is, near where the action is.
Hi, guys. Thank you very much.
Corbyn still finished second, but for him, not being obliterated, even making gains, smelled like victory.
The mandate she's got is lost Conservative seats, lost votes, lost support, and lost confidence. I would have thought that's enough to go.
But apparently she will not go. What happens now? Frankly, it's a bit of a mess. So Theresa May says she will try to cling on to power with the support of one of the smaller parties from Northern Ireland. How long can that last? We may all be back here doing this all over again in not too long a time.
Reporter Terry Schultz is in Brussels with how the EU is responding to the election results.
Though British Prime Minister Theresa May must now form a new government after losing her parliamentary majority, European Union officials say they hope there won't be a delay in Brexit negotiations. May indicated she plans to keep those talks on track. European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker says that's what Brussels expects.
As far as the Commission is concerned, we can open negotiations tomorrow morning at 9:30.
Whenever the talks start, they must end in March 2019, 2 years after May launched the process. Terry Schultz for CBS News, Brussels.
Staying overseas, a change in the ceremonial leadership of Japan is on the horizon. More from reporter Lucy Kraft in Tokyo.
In just a few seconds, Japanese lawmakers changed a nearly 200-year-old custom by allowing 83-year-old Emperor Akihito to step down. The popular emperor is expected to retire next year, handing the ceremonial post to his eldest son, Crown Prince Naruhito. Japan's monarchy is believed to be the world's oldest. Lucy Kraft, CBS News, Tokyo.
Back home, the NSA contractor who federal prosecutors say passed on classified information to a reporter has been denied bond. The government argues she damaged national security and they're raising concerns she may have put in jeopardy other state secrets. More from correspondent David Begno.
The government's lawyers say they're concerned that former Air Force linguist Reality Lee Winner may have stolen or exposed other state secrets. While Assistant U.S. Attorney Jennifer Solari called Winner extremely intelligent, she said the government's evidence against her is downright frightening. The Department of Justice says the NSA contractor has admitted to taking a top-secret intelligence document from her employer, which details hacking by the Russian military intelligence. Inside her Augusta, Georgia home, agents seized computers, 4 cell phones, and 3 guns, including an AR-15. They also found handwritten notes, including one where she allegedly said, "I want to burn the White House down." Prosecutors now allege that Winner plugged an external hard drive into a top-secret Air Force computer, but authorities don't know where that drive is located. Winner has pleaded not guilty in the Trump administration's first criminal leak case. Her defense attorney, Titus Nichols, argued the government is scraping and clawing to build a mountain out of a molehill. But prosecutors say in recorded jailhouse calls, Winner told her sister she would, quote, play the pretty white cute card. Winner's mother and stepfather testified on her behalf.
Any response?
Billie Jean Winner Davis did not want to talk after court, but she testified her daughter was a top student who taught herself Arabic when she was 17. The couple had previously spoken to CBS This Morning.
When she sees something wrong, she goes to right it. When she sees a need, she goes to fill it. She goes to fix things. She's a good person. I know that if she did do something wrong, she's ready to face the consequences, and she will.
So in denying her bail, the judge said he was concerned about Reality Winner's alleged fascination with the Middle East and her desire to meet with Taliban leadership.
David Begno reporting from the federal courthouse in Augusta, Georgia. Chelsea Manning speaking out now. She says she had a, quote, responsibility to the public to leak a trove of classified documents to WikiLeaks. Formerly known as Bradley Manning, she served 7 years of a 35-year sentence before it was commuted by President Obama. She was recently let out of federal prison. Zika's on its way back as weather warms up in most of the U.S. and mosquitoes return, and it's sparking new concerns in places like Puerto Rico.
New data from the U.S. territory shows serious birth defects in about 1 out of 12 pregnancies in Zika-infected women. Acting director of the CDC, Dr. Ann Schuchat, says this shows
Zika infection identified during any trimester of pregnancy
can lead to serious brain or other birth defects.
She says this percentage is consistent with numbers here in the U.S. The CDC says pregnant women should not let their guard down as we are in mosquito season. Sabrina Cupid for CBS News Atlanta.
Dozens of overdoses, including several deaths, are being reported in Macon, Georgia, linked to a potent street drug.
Georgia health officials say the overdoses started within the past 2 days involving pills laced with dangerous opioids.
It's being sold on the street as Percocet. However, when it's taken, the patients are experiencing significant and severe decreased levels of consciousness and respiratory failure.
That's Navison Health's Dr. Chris Hendry.
Right now, the most important thing is for the community to be aware that this is out there and is a risk to their health that is potentially lethal.
As many as 4 people have died from overdosing on the drugs. Bill Rakoff, CBS News.
Preparations are underway to mark the first anniversary of the Pulse nightclub shootings that left 49 people dead and 68 wounded.
I'm Peter King. The tributes include a huge mural unveiled at the University of Central Florida. 2 UCF students were among the 49 people killed that night. Artist Michael Pilato and his partner have been painting for 4 months.
It's a little bit of magic for us. All the hard work is worth it when we come out here and see it on the wall and seeing the students walk by and looking at it and being a part of the love.
In other tributes, galleries are displaying Pulse-related artwork. Several blood drives are being held. Organizers are distributing some 300,000 rainbow ribbons for people to wear on Monday, the anniversary and official day of remembrance here. Peter King, CBS News, Orlando.
Up next, Apple unveils its newest product.
It's designed to compete with the Amazon Echo.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
CBS Radio News podcasts are now on Spotify. Listen to great programs like Face the Nation, the CBS News Weekend Roundup, CBS This Morning, and more. They're all on your Spotify app using your iOS or Android device. CBS Radio News on Spotify, the leading global music streaming service, now lets you find the right podcast for every moment. Open Spotify to listen to CBS Radio News podcasts today.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. Uber is moving forward with its plan to change that decades-long morning and evening habit for many Americans, carpooling. Here's correspondent John Blackstone.
All right, I think I'm ready for some coffee.
It's shortly after 8 a.m. on a typical weekday morning, and both Megan Christensen and Shoshana Gould are getting ready for work. They live within blocks of each other in Oakland, California, but have never met. Both women work about 10 miles away across the bay in downtown San Francisco, and both face the same frustrating traffic obstacle known as the maze. 3 major interstates all converge at the east end of the Bay Bridge, creating a bottleneck that often delays drivers by more than an hour. For almost 40 years, the solution for thousands of commuters like Christensen and Gould has been something called casual carpool.
Hi.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning, how are you?
Good, how are you?
At more than 20 locations scattered throughout the East Bay region, people who need a ride into San Francisco line up each weekday morning and jump into the next car that pulls up.
It's like ad hoc carpooling almost.
Yeah.
Typically, the rider is expected to chip in a dollar for the toll.
Here's my dollar, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it.
But the real draw for solo drivers like Christensen, adding at least 2 passengers, gives them access to this. A restricted carpool lane onto the bridge.
So doing this, we're saving 35 minutes, something like that, probably.
Probably about that, yeah.
About 6,000 people are doing this daily.
University of California, Berkeley researcher Susan Shaheen is one of the few social scientists who've studied this almost 40-year-old phenomenon that was born during a crippling 1979 public transit strike.
We found that the median wait time for a driver was just 2 minutes.
Wow.
And they were doing this long before Lyft and Uber.
The casual carpooling, it's done without an app, and it just works.
It's completely organic.
Here we are in the home of high tech, and this low-tech system is thriving and has been for years.
You don't need an app to do everything. There are ways to live your life without that.
While some casual carpoolers are attracted to the system's analog appeal,
Many feel it was the modern sharing economy that erased fears about getting into a stranger's car.
The tech world has actually made us a little bit more trusting of people around us because we hop in the car all the time with Uber drivers and Lyft drivers.
Yeah, I feel like if you can rent a room in a stranger's apartment and sleep there comfortably, then you can get a ride comfortably with a stranger in the city.
In an age when Uber claims its users have taken more than 600 million Uber pool rides, and Lyft boasts of 28 million rides on its Lyft Line feature, casual carpool is the little transit system that predates them all and shows no signs of slowing down.
Apple unveiled some software changes and some new products at its developers conference. Let's talk now with CBS News technology consultant Larry Maggott on the line from Silicon Valley to get his take. Hi, Larry.
Hey there. Well, I think the biggest news from my perspective was this new speaker called HomePod, and it's designed to compete with the Amazon Echo and the Google Home. But the big differences are, number one, the Apple speaker, so they claim, is much, much better in terms of audio quality. It has tweeters, it has woofers, it has motors that move air around, it has technology that measures the size of the room it's in and adjusts the sound accordingly. So they're going for the audiophile market. But at $349, it's also much more expensive than the competing products out there. You can pick up an Amazon Echo Dot for $49 and then connect it to any speaker you want. And you can get a Google Home for about $110. So Apple is hoping that their appeal, their big fan base, and the fact that it's a higher quality speaker is going to get people to shell out more money.
There are other similar things on the market besides Alexa, right? There's something from Microsoft.
Yeah, well, Microsoft has technology in terms of Cortana that works with Windows, and there's no doubt that they are in the process of coming out with their own dedicated home systems as well. So we're going to see a lot of these. And the beauty of them is that they don't just play music. They answer questions. They give you the weather, traffic. You can even turn lights on and off on many of these devices. I use an Echo every night when I go to bed to turn off the lamp. And there's a lot of things you can do with these devices. The Apple one will work with Siri so that any iPhone user is going to be comfortable talking to it because they're already comfortable talking to Siri.
But, you know, we saw that SNL skit a few weeks ago about old people trying to use Alexa. How easy are these things to use? Because I don't have one.
I think that the Echo is quite easy to use. And in fact, I think it does appeal to a lot of older people who don't want to fiddle with the phone and other devices. You just talk to it. You say, Alexa, what time is it?
It's 8:36 a.m.
And it answers.
Oh, impressive. All right, so let's turn our attention to something a little bit more serious. These London attacks, this latest Paris attack, there's been a lot of backlash against social media, especially from governments who believe it's having a damaging role in information and sharing things that are going on. Tell me about that.
Well, there's no question that terrorists, like the rest of us, are using social media. Everybody does. Why shouldn't they try to take advantage of the same technologies you and I take advantage of for personal and business reasons? However, obviously, the terrorists are engaged in horrific criminal acts, and no one wants them using their service for that purpose. The problem is, how do you, A, distinguish the difference between somebody who's expressing a political opinion, which they may have a right to express, versus somebody who is in the process of grooming people to commit criminal acts? That's often a line that's difficult to determine. Beyond that, when you have the scale of a Facebook or a Google or an Apple, where you literally have billions of people using their technology, in the case of Facebook, more than a billion people, certainly almost 2 billion, it's very difficult to police that. So they right now rely on the see something, say something idea that the community, the user base, if they see something and report it, then they will follow up. But are they following up quickly enough? Not always. And is this method adequate? Not really. They need artificial intelligence software that can really go through their entire set of data and ferret out these dangerous kinds of communications, much like they now do with child pornography. They have software for that. So that's the challenge for the Facebooks and the Googles of the world. It's not as if they want to aid and abet terrorists. They don't. But they really have a tough time doing it, given their platforms. And also, as I mentioned earlier, they have to be careful about free speech. Not to say that terrorists should have the right to use the services, but they don't want to infringe on the free speech rights of people who are using it in legitimate ways.
CBS News technology contributor Larry Magid. As always, it's good hearing from you.
Thanks so much, Steve.
Coming up on the Weekend Roundup, Kevin Spacey on House of Cards.
We were challenged to keep the show surprising and moving in directions that were unexpected.
Follow us on Twitter. We've got headlines at CBS Radio News, and I'm tweeting at Steve_Dorsey on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. CBS News correspondent Steve Kathan spoke with actor Kevin Spacey for the Weekend Roundup. Spacey talks about some upcoming projects and how parts of his Netflix show, House of Cards, are coming to life in Washington.
So much to talk about with the great actor Kevin Spacey, who's with us. First off, you're hosting the Tonys on CBS. That's exciting.
It is. I grew up watching the Tony Awards, and I have so many memories of watching incredible performances from actors in the musicals. I remember seeing Katharine Hepburn do Coco one year and watching the actors that I really admired and who really had a big influence on me, Jack Lemmon and Robards and Colleen Dewhurst. And so for me to have a chance now at this point in my life to celebrate the American theater, the living theater, what Broadway is very, very exciting. I'm looking forward to it.
And, of course, you've done so much work in London at the Old Vic, you know, and now Arthur Ashe Stadium in New York in a week.
Yeah.
A one-man effort, Clarence Darrow.
Yeah, now for people who think we're selling out 25,000 seats, we're not. The idea came to me because I happen to be a tennis fan, and I go to the U.S. Open every year. And so 2 years ago, this idea first came to me, and then it got cemented last year. But on opening night, they don't play tennis. They do a benefit for the USTA educational wing, and there's a concert on the court. And so it's lit like a concert stage. It's not lit like a tennis court. And I was sitting there watching, I think it was Phil Collins, and I suddenly started looking around, and I thought, wait a minute, this is actually an amazing space. And when it's lit differently, I suddenly thought, you know, drama happens on that court all the time. But never like real drama in the sense of doing theater. I thought, I wonder if you could turn this place into a theater. So I looked around. I thought about it for a long time. I then presented it to a number of people. They all thought I was out of my mind. but as we've gotten closer and closer to doing it, and as we eventually approached Arthur Ashe, they were absolutely 150% behind the idea. They loved the notion of being able to repurpose the venue. So we're building a stage on the court. We're bringing in 600 additional seats on the court, of which 400 will be for young people, of which 250 of those will be tickets we're giving away to 18 to 25-year-olds. And people can go to KevinSpaceyFoundation.com in order to find out that information, or KevinSpacey.com to sign up for the lottery to get those tickets. And that's, for me, one of the most important aspects of doing this is to be able to make theater affordable and inviting for young people to come and see, as well as the fact that I think that Clarence Darrow is a voice that maybe people would be, it would be of value for people to hear.
What about that? I mean, Darrow was an amazing attorney. You're bringing him to life.
He worked as an attorney in the 20s and 30s and 40s. He had a very lengthy career. He started as a civil rights attorney. He then became an extraordinary, he was a labor attorney, then a civil rights attorney, then a criminal defense attorney. He handled cases that no one else wanted, quite controversial cases and quite controversial clients. And I think at a time when we are dealing with so much negativity and difficulty and sadness, his homespun logic, his ability to remove politics and remove statistics and just tell people's very personal stories is a very powerful thing.
And you bring the audience in on this, too. I mean, you interact with them.
Yeah,
this is a one-man show.
They are very much part of the evening. I go out into the audience quite a lot. They become my juries. And because it's in the round, there's something quite remarkable, I think, about an audience watching a play. If we play in front of 5,000, 7,000 people, to me, that's going to be a remarkable experience.
So there's the Tonys, there's Darrow. You have a movie coming out at the end of the month.
That's right.
I don't know where you find the time. It's called Baby Driver.
Yeah, Edgar Wright's new film, yeah.
Tell
He's the guy
that
did all the Shaun of the Dead movies and Scott Pilgrim Against the World. And this is a really, really fun heist movie that Ansel Elgort and I are in. Jamie Foxx is in. John Hamm is in. And I play sort of the leader of that gang. And it was just a joy to do.
So action, drama, maybe some humor thrown in.
Absolutely. That kind of the... Yeah, and an amazing soundtrack.
Yeah.
Really great soundtrack.
I bet. And people are gobbling up House of Cards as we speak on Netflix. Certainly that season is unfolding. I'm about halfway through, I have to say, of the current season. What about Frank Underwood and his development as a character for you? He's in power now. You've played him reaching the heights of power. Different now?
Yeah, it's been such an amazing journey to, from the very beginning, to figuring out who Frank Underwood was, how we were going to approach doing it, the incredible encouragement and help I got from David Fincher and our showrunner, Bo Willimon, who I just think wrote extraordinary. The first two scripts were remarkable. And then really led us right through to season, the end of season four. And now having done season five, in which we were challenged to keep the show surprising and moving in directions that were unexpected. And I just keep learning more about this man as the onion gets peeled every year. And you know, I thought it couldn't be more fun, but it is more fun. Every year I have more fun. It's more exciting. It's more challenging. It's more entertaining for me to be a part of. And I'm very lucky to have an incredible cast surrounding me and a great writing team.
What about the comparisons now to current politics with what we have going on in Washington? There's gridlock. There's President Trump. Certainly we've seen things we haven't seen before in real life. Is there a kind of a who can outdo the other here?
Well, I mean, you know, we've never felt an obligation to compete with the real world. And in fact, what's been kind of interesting from our perspective is that every season, sometime between when we shoot our series and when it drops, something or five things that are very close to what we developed and dealt with in our show happens sort of in the real world. And we always think people are going to think we ripped it from the headlines, but it's actually been the other way around. Perhaps people see parallels and perhaps things that might have seemed impossible or crazy, that kind of thing would never happen, maybe perhaps now seem a little more plausible.
You've always been socially active. Are you more politically engaged? I mean, do you keep up with it more since you've taken on this role? Is it more of a part of your life?
I've always been engaged. You know, doing the show hasn't increased that or decreased that for me. I've always been interested in you know, what I think is a remarkable thing that people are able to do, which is to go into public service. It's not always encouraging, and it's not always looks like a profession some people want to join, but I hope that either our show or the real world doesn't discourage people from realizing the value of getting involved.
And for you, what's next?
I'm off once I'm done with Clarence Darrow, I'm then off to Europe, where I'm going to join a film that's already shooting now called All the Money in the World that Ridley Scott is making about the famous notorious kidnapping of J. Paul Getty's grandson in the 1970s, and I'm playing J. Paul Getty. So they have to age me up because he was 79 when this all happened.
Wow.
But it's my first chance to work with Ridley, and I'm very, very excited.
Kevin Spacey, thanks.
You bet. Thank you.
Coming up, a cheat day gets a new meaning on the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
Check out CBS Radio News podcasts. From hard news to features, there's lots available from our app. Listen to experts like John Dickerson each Sunday on Face the Nation or Scott Pelley every weeknight on the CBS Evening News. There's the World News Roundup, America's longest-running network newscast, and the Weekend Roundup, our weekend review magazine show. It's all available from CBSRadioNews.com or on our app for iOS and Android.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. Videos a teenager made before killing himself are now key evidence in the trial of his girlfriend accused of texting him to death. Here's correspondent Aaron Moriarty.
They show Conrad Roy speaking candidly about his inner turmoil. But that's something that also could help the defense. Michelle Carter's attorneys argue that Roy was already suicidal long before he met her.
This is Conrad Henry Roy III reporting about social anxiety.
At times, Conrad Roy seemed brimming with hope in his videos.
I just got a job from the Boston Duck Tourists to captain their boat. Like, that's a huge accomplishment.
But later, his despair came into focus.
It's no good. Trash. We'll never be successful. Never have a wife. Never have kids. Never learn.
In July 2014, Roy died inside this truck from carbon monoxide poisoning. As he was dying, prosecutors say, he was on the phone with Michelle Carter for 46 minutes. Days before, in numerous texts, Carter, then 17, offered Roy suggestions on how to take his own life and lectured him when he wavered. But I'm tired of you not taking this seriously. Like, if you aren't really going to do it, then stop pretending that you are, one message said. Another read, hang yourself, jump off a building, stab yourself. I don't know. There's a lot of ways. Carter's lawyers say investigators ignored texts she sent trying to help him.
I'm trying to do the best to dig you out. You're not aware of that, are you?
No, I'm not.
And you're probably not aware that he said, I don't want to be dug out.
No.
Are you aware that he said he wanted to kill himself?
No.
The defense is expected to blame Carter's medication for her odd behavior and argue responsibility for Roy's death ultimately lies with him.
In the manner of death?
Yes. I marked that as suicide.
Okay. And there was also a box that you could have marked a homicide.
Correct.
In order to be convicted on the manslaughter charge, the judge would have to agree that Carter's words caused Roy's death. Unfortunately, Massachusetts is one of the only 11 states without a law that's making it a crime to encourage a suicide.
Aaron Moriarty reporting. A painting found in a garage, of all places, may turn its owner into a multimillionaire. It's by the artist Jackson Pollock, who died 60 years ago. That painting could be worth $15 million. More from correspondent Vladimir Dutier.
We asked ourselves immediately what everyone else would, why is this in Arizona?
When Josh Levine's auction firm was called to this retirement community in Arizona in 2015, they stumbled on what appeared to be hidden treasure.
It was all packed up, just all in piles. You could see library boxes of personal effects, the way tax returns, letters, correspondence, and then these stacks of art.
Inside this garage, Levine says he found famous works of art and what he believes is the work of abstract impressionist Jackson Pollock.
This will be the biggest thing I've ever represented in my life.
The art had been sitting in the Arizona garage since 1992 when the owner, who wishes to remain unnamed, inherited it from his sister.
Jennifer Gordon was a socialite in the New York scene, in the art world, at the right place at the right time. All the artists were hanging out at her apartment, including Jackson Pollock.
Finding the painting was the easy part. Levine reportedly spent more than $50,000 on forensic reports to date the pigment and on a private investigator who confirmed Gordon hung out with New York's famous art lovers, the Guggenheims.
I really looked at it all over and under magnification.
Appraiser Sean Morton was asked to assess the painting.
When I first saw the painting, I was a little skeptical until I learned of the owner and her relationship with Jackson Pollock.
Numerous lawsuits have erupted through the years over the authenticity of Pollock's paintings. Many have been found in unusual places. Levine is convinced his discovery is genuine.
We have everything we know. The only thing I don't have is a photograph of Jennifer standing next to Jackson going, hey, look, here's our painting.
One other thing he doesn't have, a check. Vladimir Dutier reporting. Now to a whole new meaning to cheat days. Correspondent Gilma Avalos introduces us to a man who wanted to stay anonymous and helps people cheat on their Fitbits.
Put the Fitbit in a sock, hour and a half on no heat setting in the dryer, 11,000 steps, thank you.
He's earning 11,000 steps without moving. As is the case for many employees, his pedometer is linked to company insurance incentives that can lower his payments.
You are now more involved in, well, how much is this bill? How many steps?
Companies benefit from a healthy workforce, and many are rewarding workers with freebies for getting fit. But there's also a growing movement online to cheat the system.
We're starting with 3,472 steps.
We were curious, do the hacks even work? So we ran our own unscientific test.
This does still take some effort on your part to sit here and press this button for a while. Okay, there's a minute. 3,541.
That equals about 70 steps. This is the bike hack. Our attempts with this one, not so successful. Blame it on user error?
Seems like a lot of work, though, to get this to change.
Yeah, because you still got to push that wheel.
And if you've ever wondered about letting your best friend take the steps for you, Woody wore his human's Fitbit for a day, picked up about 2,500 steps. But Dr. James Morgan says when people cheat the system and miss out on the exercise,
they're really just cheating themselves.
Gilma Avalos for CBS News Dallas.
A pioneering pilot is retiring.
Louis Freeman, the first African-American to become the chief pilot at a major U.S. airline, is retiring after 37 years in the cockpit with Southwest. The color barrier in airline cockpits wasn't broken until the mid-1960s, and even today, only 3% of pilots are black. Freeman says his most memorable flight was the one that carried the body of civil rights icon Rosa Parks to her final resting place. Freeman made his last flight a few days before turning 65, the mandatory retirement age for airline pilots. Frank Settapani, CBS News.
We end this weekend with an icon of soul taking over another street.
What you want?
She's so good, she's getting a second street named after her in Detroit, Aretha's Way.
Detroit has been with me. They were there when no one else knew who I was, and I've been with them every step of the way.
Franklin, who already boasts a street named Aretha Avenue, is the latest of the city's music giants to be honored with a street renaming. There's Berry Gordy Boulevard, Glenn Frey Drive, and Stevie Wonder Avenue. Pam Coulter, CBS News.
That does it for the Weekend Roundup. Thanks for listening. We want to get your feedback. Send us your story ideas, autograph requests, home remedies, whatever, to weekendroundup@cbsnews.com. The show's always online on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, and now Spotify. The Weekend Roundup is produced at the CBS News Washington Bureau. Lou Walker is the technical supervisor. Dory Valerio is the production assistant in New York. Have a great week. I'm Steve Dorsey, CBS News.